Take a network break. Grab a virtual donut and join us for this week's sprint through the latest tech news, including stories from Aruba, Extreme, Cisco, and more. We've got a couple of sponsor notes. First, our sponsor today is Linode. You deserve simple, affordable, and accessible cloud computing. Simplify your cloud infrastructure with Linode's Linux virtual machines and develop, deploy, and scale your modern apps faster and easier. Go to linode.com/networkbreak and find out more, and you can get $100 in free credit. We're also sponsored today by Service Express. They are leaders in third-party data center maintenance. You can lower your post-warranty support costs, take control of your hardware refresh cycle, and extend the life of your server storage and network equipment. Visit serviceexpress.com/packetpushers, and while you're there, you can learn how you can win a $100 Amazon gift card. That's $200 for people here today. It's not bad.
That's an interesting way to do things. That's a new thing,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Lure them in.
And it's not even us that's giving it away.
It's not coming out of our pockets.
Exactly.
And also stay tuned after the news. We have a Tech Bytes podcast with Zscaler. We're going to be talking about how to prevent a ransomware attack against your organization. That is very timely.
Yeah.
All right, let's get into the news. First, HPE's Aruba is advising customers to upgrade the software on their 6300 and 6400 model switches due to a flaw that could brick the onboard storage on the switches. That's a problem. If you're running software older than 10.04.3031 version of the Aruba OS, the device could write memory at, quote, an unintended and accelerated pace, end quote, that could degrade the device's SSD drive.
Not much to say here except to draw it to your attention, just in case you've missed it somehow. I'm sure HPE Aruba is doing their best to reach out to you. So if you haven't heard of it before, this is a bit of a showstopper. The idea that you can brick your equipment and there's no way back, that's probably the thing to take note here.
So links in the show notes if you need to go and start doing those updates. There is a software update that will fix that.
Mm-hmm.
Moving on, Kemp, they're best known for their load balancer products. They've announced they're going to acquire Flowmon Networks for an undisclosed amount. Flowmon is a Czech company. They monitor flow records for security and performance monitoring.
So Kemp is a load balancing company. They've been around for a number of years. Probably the thing, actually been around for more than a decade, I think.
Quite a while, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, quite a while. And sort of been in the background. They've never managed to come to the fore. They're a British company, been producing, and they focused at the low end of the market for the longest time. And if I recall correctly, they took a substantial investment round recently, got a new management team in, and they've become much more aggressive around the marketing. They've made their website look respectable.
That always helps. Is,
yeah, actually looks like it's like something I'd expect to see. So I think Kemp's going through a bit of a renaissance with its load balancing tool. And like most load balancer companies, they've realized that you can adapt their proxy technology to become a security technology. Mm-hmm. And you can also use your load balancer as a network monitoring system. So the idea is that as data moves across your load balancer, then you can use that to collect net monitoring data and then attach a monitoring and an analytics system and then start to pitch your load balancer as a visibility tool. We've seen this any number of times. Of course, if you look at F5 Networks, they've turned their load balancers into service meshes by the acquisition of Nginx. And really, these companies aren't load balancers anymore. They're appliances, and they're trying to bolt on features as they try and find a product market fit for post-load balancing world.
Yes. We're also seeing sort of a renewed interest in extracting network telemetry, network data of all types for performance monitoring, security monitoring. So this gels nicely with that. And it's a good, I think, buy for Kemp because it's not biting into their existing market. They sort of are, this is additive.
Well, I think the from a customer perspective, the problem that I have is that it's very exciting that every product now has visibility and monitoring as a standard feature. Mm-hmm. You buy an SD-WAN, you get your monitoring. You buy a software overlay for the data center, you get your visibility tooling. You know, you buy a campus network now and it's got overlays, and so all of a sudden you've got all this monitoring and telemetry with your SDN platform. The challenge that I now see is that with companies like F5 having a monitoring and Kemp having a monitoring platform, is you've now got multiple panes of glass. And you then have to make a decision about whether you want to have a visibility tool for each product or whether you want to have an end-to-end visibility tool that transcends these products. And we've done another number of podcasts, sponsored podcasts lately with companies like AppNeta and others who provide these monitoring platforms that are independent of the devices in the network. Mm-hmm. And so you could end up with this sort of mishmash of devices and networking technologies that have their own, you know, the SD-WAN's got a visibility monitoring tool, but it doesn't monitor the bits that aren't on the SD-WAN. So that's kind of limited. Like, it, and there's a trade-off there, a decision you have to make about how you want to do that.
Yeah, that's always been an issue. And the notion of a single pane of glass has always been aspirational rather than factual. I think everybody tries to sell you one, but they just don't really exist because there's so many different things you need to keep an eye on and so many different ways you can extract data from your environment, your infrastructure, that the single pane of glass doesn't exist.
Well, the thing is that it is a single pane of glass for whatever it monitors. Which is, so it's not.
yeah. So it's like my cupboard. It's a collection of glasses and I fill them up as needed.
That's right. Yeah. And it's like, and so technically, you know, when they sell it as a single pane of glass, it's right for the product that they sell. You've got a single pane of glass for monitoring your product.
For this slice of
your world.
Because
you don't have to have a third party product or a number of third party products. The challenge, of course, is that end-to-end monitoring is now still necessary. So, like, I think this is a good move in one way. But in another way, you know, it's only a matter of time until Kemp starts to throw in threat management and security scanning. I imagine sometime, well, 6 to 9 months, Drew, do you think?
Okay, we'll put that on the sheet. Because on the prediction,
because that's
record.
The next step. You know, you go out and buy a threat management company or you buy a threat management feed from somebody and just say, as you see the flows come in, you match them up and then you discard, you know, do whatever you want to do with them.
Yeah. All right, links in the show notes if you want to find out more. Let's move on. The cloud-native networking startup Isovalent has earned $29 million in funding from investors including Andreessen Horowitz, Google, and Cisco. Isovalent offers commercial support for its Linux-based networking software that's based on Cilium and the EBPF open source projects.
So just to show you that service mesh and Kubernetes hasn't run out of people to throw money at it.
No, sir.
Like Kubernetes generally is still getting money thrown at it. We've got another comedy story about Kubernetes later on in the show. Cilium has been probably one of the most technically advanced organizations in developing an accelerated networking path through Linux. That is, they've gone into the Linux networking stack and worked heavily on the eBPF to find a way to make a whole range of services using the Linux network stack to its absolute maximum performance. And that is its key value proposition, is that they are bringing a service mesh which is fully featured. You know, they support the maglev network load balancing functionality and a range of other things. And this has obviously caught the eye of Martin Casado of VMware NSX fame, of course. And he's managed to convince the investment people at A16Z to throw $29 million to turn that into a product.
Yes. Well, it helps that they both knew each other at Stanford. It turns out that Martin Casado was the teaching assistant in a class that one of the co-founders of Isovalent was taking. So connections matter.
Well, yes, the whole of Silicon Valley is all, you know, friends helping friends and
yes.
Students. And, you know, it's a little bit hard to know sometimes whether they're just talking to each other because they talk to each other or whether they've actually got something smarter or better than somebody else. So,
yeah, well, this whole Linux kernel and Kubernetes networking space, I think it feels like the new gold rush. Container networking interfaces is the hot area. You've got things like already Calico, Conti, even Antria. Now Cilium is here as well. I guess what I'm hearing about Cilium and the way they work with eBPF is that it's essentially an abstraction layer for the Linux kernel and that you don't have to go in and rewrite the kernel. You can use Cilium to do all kinds of neat networking tricks sort of at an abstraction layer.
Yeah, it's a little difficult to explain, really, but I think it's this technically superior networking stack that's been optimized to run a service mesh. I mean, once you've got the agent inside of Linux that's better than your competitors, you add on an SDN, and then all of a sudden you've got a product that you can flog off, right?
Right.
Challenge that I have here is how does Cilium compete against Google, you know, GKS or any one of the other 2,975 Kubernetes distributions? Or AWS Outposts or Azure On-Prem, you know, whatever they're called this week. I'm not entirely convinced that there's a viable way forward for these people to, you know, are we looking to sell? Are we looking to have a I don't know.
I'm assuming since it's Andreessen Horowitz that they're looking to sell. I don't know that VMware is going to be the same exit that option that it was for Martin back with Nicira when they bought it and turned it into NSX, because VMware has their own Tanzu service mesh and Antria they're backing. But I noticed that Cisco was an investor in this round, so maybe Cisco is hoping to stake out some early territory here if they decide they also need a CNI. They've got a foot in the door.
Well, I think Cisco's got an investment group that continuously looking around Silicon Valley and making investments. And my understanding of that situation is that Cisco's looking for market intelligence as much as they are looking for companies to buy. Uh-huh. So one of the best ways to know what's happening in a given market, Kubernetes Service Mesh, for example, is to take investments in these companies, spend $10 million. It's cheaper than the consultants, like cheaper than a McKinsey consultant or a Gartner consultant, to be fair. And you might even make some money out of it, you know?
You might, or at least snap up some good intellectual property, or at least get yourself associated with a popular and hot open source space like Cilium.
Yeah, well, these companies all have investment arms that, you know, here's $500 million, go and make some investments, don't lose it sort of thing. Right. And but, you know, my understanding is that they generally don't do awesomely well. They're mostly used as a market research to understand what's happening, what does the startup space look like, and also for recruitment. So as these startups fail, a lot of the big companies like to go and buy the remnants of these companies as a way to get a lot of very good talent on the books for a period of time. So
yes.
If you want to boost your service mesh. So recruiting people is very expensive, especially in Silicon Valley. Finding people in Silicon Valley to work for you is very expensive, and their housing and everything. So nobody wants to work there anymore. So it's easier to oftentimes to buy a startup. 10, 20 million is cheaper than recruiting 30 or 40 people.
Yeah. Yeah.
That sounds weird, but that's actually a truth.
Right. So we'll keep an eye on Isovalent. Apparently, they are the new darling. And I think actually Ethan Banks and Ned Bellavance will be doing a Day 2 Cloud interview with them coming up. So if you're interested, keep an ear out for that.
Yeah, there's a really good blog post on the Cilium.io website where they dive into how eBPF. It has taken 6 years for eBPF to change the way it works. But as you say, I think the trick here is that Project Monterey from VMware has probably beat them to market. VMware's got a big footprint in the enterprise, and these people have to have something much better than what Project Monterey with DPU acceleration gives. It's all one fine to say we can accelerate Linux, but if you've got a hardware NIC, a DPU or a smart NIC accelerating your networking functions, maybe the software acceleration doesn't matter.
Right. Yeah. I think that maybe Isovalent's issue in terms of looking for an exit is VMware seems to be staking out their space already without needing to rely on buying a startup. But who knows?
We'll see. VMware's bought so many startups in the last year. It's hard to, you know, they have visibility. They bought Nyansa. They bought security startups. Gosh, they've spent, like, there's been like 20
Hobby
of them.
Networks. Yeah.
You know, for load balancing and all that sort of stuff. And,
Yeah. No. All right. Well, links in the show notes if you want to know more. Let's move on. Take a quick break to tell you about our sponsor today, Linode. Whether you're working on a personal project or managing enterprise infrastructure, you deserve simple, affordable, and accessible cloud computing solutions that let you take your project to the next level. You can simplify your cloud infrastructure with Linode's Linux virtual machines and develop, deploy, and scale your modern apps faster and easier. You can get started on Linode today with $100 in free credit for listeners of Network Break. You can find all the details at linode.com/networkbreak. They've got 11 global data centers. They provide 24/7/365 human support. There are no tiers or handoffs, regardless of your plan size. In addition to shared and dedicated compute instances, you can use your $100 in credit on S3-compatible object storage, manage Kubernetes, and more. So host your website, build your app, store or backup media. It's up to you, and it's all free with $100 in Linode credit. Visit linode.com/networkbreak. Click on the Create Free Account button to get started. You can also check out Linode's new YouTube channel for video tutorials, security tips, and more. That's at youtube.com/Linode. And we're happy to welcome Linode to the Network Break advertising family.
Yeah, and I've been using Linode's tutorials on Linux for years and years, so I think the YouTube channel would be a welcome addition.
All right, go check it out. Back to the news. Extreme Networks, they've announced their own version of AWS Outpost, that is a pre-built bundle of memory, compute, and high-speed disk and storage. It's delivered to the customer's premises and managed by the vendor. Extreme's calling its version the Extreme Cloud Appliance, or XCA, and beta testing will start in January of 2021.
So let me try and summarize this. The solution will consist of three hardware appliances, CPU, memory, and disk, and these appliances will be clustered together into a fault-tolerant platform hosting a Kubernetes infrastructure and onboarded as easily as you can an access point. I'm quoting from something they said in their blog post. Once online through automation magic from our world-class cloud operations team, the XCA platform will phone home and allow us to manage the appliances for a customer and install and operate XIQ. That's Extreme Cloud Appliance. Anyway, so the challenge here, Drew, is we were just poking fun at the 2,976 different Kubernetes distributions. Mm-hmm. This is another one. So I don't know, or I'm not convinced that customers buy Kubernetes and then deploy it and say, all right, now what are we going to put in it?
No, that's not the way to do it.
That is kind of how we buy VMware. We buy VMware for VMs. But what we're doing with the VMs is we're saying we're taking your existing physical servers and porting them into virtual machines, and lo and behold, we've improved things. I am not at all convinced that that offering a competitor AWS Outposts is exactly the right answer. AWS Outposts is a competitive response to people saying, I want your AWS stuff, but I want it on my premises.
Right.
So I want all of your orchestration engine. Send me something that'll get that. And that's what that is. Or, you know, and it helps to, you know, there's probably marketing exercises and things where it says, you know, you can do whatever. I'm not too sure that Extreme's understood the value proposition here or the market proposition. But, you know, okay, Extreme's got a Kubernetes product and they're going to sell it to you and you can come and bring your containers and deploy them on-prem. There you go. What do you think?
Yeah, I guess, I mean, Outpost to me was always, if you're looking to do that hybrid cloud where you want to have connectivity among workloads on-prem and in the cloud, AWS Outpost could bring that to you. And Extreme isn't really in that hybrid cloud game. I guess it's more like I'm uncomfortable running some particular container workload in a public cloud. I want to have it on-prem, or I need it at some edge location. Now I can buy hardware from Extreme and Extreme's going to manage it. Yeah, I think there is an opportunity there. I don't know that it's a huge opportunity, but you know, we know Extreme strategy is throw everything at the wall and see what sticks. And so, you know, here's some managed infrastructure that if you need it, they'll have it.
Well, I could make sense of this if I thought there was people out there saying, I've got an app and it runs in containers. I need a Kubernetes platform. Mm-hmm. And there you go. But I'm not sure that anybody's asked for that. I get the sense that, you know, with VMware's Tanzu, for example, they sort of, that's more of an accessory to VMware's ESX hypervisor, you know, and they're part of their cloud orchestration, the VMware Cloud Foundation engine. So I guess there's something, but I mean, the flip side here is probably didn't have to do a lot of work. They've got the cloud platform that they're using to monitor Wi-Fi and campus.
Yep.
So probably didn't have to do a whole lot of extra work to add some features just to be able to run a Kubernetes cluster from a cloud platform. So maybe it's just us, you know, a handful of people in a corner. It probably hasn't cost them a lot of money. Probably spent half a dozen people for less than 6 months to get a Kubernetes deployment off the ground. Yeah,
I think so. It does seem like a low-risk investment for Extreme to be able to say to companies, yeah, you're looking for managed hardware, we've got that. Mm. And it happens to be ready for your Kubernetes-based applications.
Would also point out that if you're a customer and if you've got six people who can spend 6 months, you could actually do all this yourself and actually get a customized solution to what you exactly want. Why you'd pay somebody else to do it.
And people pay IT vendors to do things for them all the time, whether or not it's a good idea. So,
yeah, for sure. I don't know. I'm going to put this one in the bucket of just because you can doesn't mean you should. I don't know that this is a smart idea.
That's a big bucket.
That's a resonate. I mean, I understand that they can do it. Probably didn't take a lot of effort. This is a good choice. It is complimentary. But, you know, I'm imagining that a lot of Extreme's customers are federal governments, schools, education, especially in the US. Mm-hmm. They're a big part of the K-12. Are schools really looking for a managed Kubernetes infrastructure so that things can come on-prem and run in containers? I'm not sure that I could take that hypothesis on board.
Right. Well, there is going to be a beta in January, so maybe we'll hear more about it from Extreme and maybe we can get a briefing and get some more insight. But in the meantime, there's a link if you want to go find out more. Moving on, Google's parent company Alphabet has announced it's going to start delivering wireless internet in Kenya using free space optics. This is called Project Tara. It's an effort that uses light beams to transmit wireless internet in places where it's too difficult or expensive to lay fiber.
You know, the only thing that surprises me about this is how long it's taken for people to start using infrared lasers again to transmit data. I was deploying infrared lasers on tops of buildings in the late 90s. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't awesome, but, you know, 20 years of innovation or theoretically should have turned them into something exciting. So using lasers to get 20 kilometers and 20 gigabits of bandwidth doesn't seem that innovative to me. Am I wrong?
No, I don't think you're wrong in terms of the actual innovation. I think it's always about deployment. We talk about all the time about how things like SpaceX are trying to get rural broadband capabilities up using satellites. But here's an option. You can do that without having to go to space. You just set up some towers and beam a link from one tower to the next. It makes perfect sense. And I don't understand why, you're right, that it hasn't happened sooner.
This technology is not like it's been around for years.
Yeah.
And the actual optical transmitters have been around for decades. It's not like they've invented infrared lasers to carry data. That's been around, like I said, for 30 years or more. So I don't know. It doesn't sound like a moonshot. It sounds like, duh, obvious. But because Google's doing it, it's going to be like, oh, look what we did because, you know, with Google and whatever.
Possibly one of the issues is around, like Google said, they're working with Echonet Group, which I guess is a telecom group within Kenya. So that may be the issue. There are probably regulatory requirements, business requirements, and who knows what else to get these kind of projects off the ground. So it may be less a technology issue and more of a red tape issue to get these projects going.
Yeah, and that brings me to another pain point. Sub-Saharan Africa is not Kenya. Kenya is one country. Right? That's like saying bringing light-speed internet to the USA and then deploying it in Texas.
Yes, all of sub-Saharan Africa is probably about equal in landmass to the United States. So
exactly.
That is much of an overstatement, yes.
I mean, how you can bloviate. You're deploying it in one country out of a, you know, if you took Africa and turned it into 50 states, then it would be like you've installed it in one state. And it's just a little bit angry about that. That it's, you know, that sort of parochial colonialism, just casual stuff going on is really quite, Anyway, so it's only in Kenya. It's a pilot project using technology that's been around for 30 years, that's been iterating anyway. Yay, I suppose.
What I'm hoping to see is, one, getting broadband access in places where people need it and could use it in a way that is efficient and potentially low cost. Because
this isn't consumer broadband. This is backhaul.
Right. Well, yeah, no, I mean, it does sound like...
Doesn't work for providing broadband to the home.
Unless you set up some kind of wireless infrastructure, I guess, at the base of the tower to broadcast out. Yeah.
Yeah, this is going to be 5G to 5G. So where you can actually make power, you put up a 5G base station, you can start to use these lasers to backhaul traffic between the two. And that's pretty widespread use today already. A lot of people use microwave, but sometimes they use infrared lasers as backups or primaries. The advantage of lasers, of course, is they don't make wireless, so they don't need spectrum allocation and they don't need to be, you know, registered with the government. You just set them up.
Yeah.
However, infrared lasers are very vulnerable to rain, mist, fog, dust.
Yes. That was also not mentioned in the blog, that there are... problems with this technology, including things like rain, which are pretty common.
Your data rate drops off substantially and can even actually stop. We used to have that problem in Australia when the tropical rains came through. Mm-hmm. The infrared lasers would stop for the duration of the rainstorm, which usually isn't long. Like tropical rainstorms are only like 30 minutes or an hour. So it's not the fall over to a failback position. And by the time anybody's complaining, it's fixed itself. So.
Yeah. I guess one of the reasons I brought this up is in part because, one, it's good to see projects like this happening because, at least here in the United States, the local ISPs have such a hammerlock on the market that any movement toward other options for getting potential competition, I see, is a good thing.
Yeah, government control. A lot of the telcos are actually used as pork barrels by the politicians. You know, in the same way that the defense industry in the US gives certain states manufacturing deals or, you know, military bases which keep their economies going. Same sort of thing happens in Africa with the telcos.
Right. And here in the US, it's because of capitalism and monopolies that we have such poor service. But anyway, that's a different issue. I'm glad to see this happening. Hopefully it will actually roll into something more expansive. But in any case, if you want to find out about it, as always, links in the show notes. All right, one more ad from our second sponsor today, Service Express. Don't let the OEM swipe your IT budget. If buying new data center hardware isn't an option, consider third-party maintenance from Service Express. You can lower your support costs, extend the life of your equipment, and save your IT budget. Refresh your service, not your hardware. Service Express offers real-time hardware issue alerts, automated ticketing, 30-minute engineer callback, dedicated local primary and secondary engineers, and they have a 97% first-trip repair success rate. Visit serviceexpress.com/packetpushers, and while you're there, you can find out how you can win a $100 Amazon gift card. That's serviceexpress.com/packetpushers. All right, our last story for today. Cisco reported their financial results for Q1 of their fiscal year 2021. Top line is they posted revenues of $11.9 billion, which is down 9% year over year, and a net income of $2.2 billion, down 26% versus last year.
And when you say it like that, it sounds pretty dire, doesn't it?
It doesn't sound good.
Yeah. Down 10%. Obviously, fingers being pointed at pandemic and COVID substantially. But in the discussions with financial analysts, when you read the transcripts, Cisco's Chuck Robbins is making the point that, don't tell me what I did for yesterday. Let me tell you what I'm going to do for you in the next quarter. Uh-huh. And points to various pieces of growth and highlights. But I think really the financial analysts are looking at the dividend. And it doesn't really matter what happens to Cisco sales. George Notter at Jefferies said, as with prior economic recessions, we expect that Cisco will take steps to preserve its earnings per share power in the business with headcount layoffs and other cost reductions. We note that earnings per share power for the business fell only marginally during the global financial crisis of 2008-09 and rebounded nicely in 2010. Dividend yield should help to protect the downside in the stock. So what he's basically saying is that Cisco has committed to $1 billion worth of cost cuts. They believe that 70% of that will be in headcount, 30% of that will be in cost of goods sold. So Cisco will go out and reduce the cost of the components in its boxes, buying cheaper or beating up its suppliers or doing other things to reduce the cost of its supply chain. Maybe have less developers, focus less on testing and quality to keep the cost down is probably a pretty typical sort of thing that we've seen Cisco do in the past. But the dividend or the earnings per share will keep rich because Cisco is one of the few technology stocks that actually pays the dividend. Doesn't matter if the total revenue drops by 10% as long as there's a viable excuse. And we've had that discussion pretty solidly over a period of time. The other thing that the share market liked is that Cisco generated 5% year-on-year growth in public sector product orders during the quarter. They saw strength in both the U.S. and overseas governmental organizations. They noted particular strength among the U.S. Federal Department of Defense and K-12 schools, including the E-rate subsidy program. So we talked before about the exit of Huawei from the U.S. market would be a boost to U.S. technology companies, and that would appear to be the case here. Those are the markets that were previously very strong with lower cost providers. They are price sensitive buyers as long as the features are met. And I think Cisco is taking that opportunity to sell American products to American companies.
Yeah, for sure. CEO Chuck Robbins called this result, quote, a solid start to the new fiscal year, given the macroeconomic uncertainty of the pandemic with the revenue and income down. I take solid start to mean it could have been worse. And based on what you read from George Notter at Jefferies, the fact that Cisco has a track record of managing its way through fiscal crisis, that the general consensus is it's going to be fine. They'll figure it out.
Well, I think,
don't panic.
I mean, you don't shed $1 billion worth of costs without something changing. And as best as we can tell, most of the change at Cisco has been to get rid of sales. So indirect sales support, reseller support channels, product managers has been pretty much wiped out. We've seen entire tax being shut down. I believe that quite a few of the tacks in the first world have been closed just outright, completely. So now all the calls are being routed into low-cost labor jurisdictions like India and Indonesia, which is, as long as you're getting the right levels of service, then that's probably okay. I think it was interesting that the infrastructure platforms product segment declined 16% year over year. So this is, the enterprise infrastructure, so servers, routers, switches, all that stuff, storage and that, declined 16%. So Cisco got 20% smaller year over year in the last quarter. And I suspect that I'm going to say, based on the feedback that I'm getting, that Cisco is really driving customers to subscriptions and that a lot of customers are churning out. That is, they're saying, well, we don't want those subscriptions. And Cisco's saying, well, you're either with us or you're against us. And if you don't buy the subscription, we're not in business with you. I'm sure they don't actually say that out loud, but that's the messaging. And I suspect that Cisco's losing a lot of customers, but they're okay with that because the customers that are left, they're getting 30% more revenue from and therefore more profits for less customers. Less customers and the same profit means less cost. And that's okay with them, I think. Huh. That's their new business model. They don't want to be dominating the market. I think they've given in to a large extent. They're not going to be the number one supplier. But the customers that they have are going to be the customers that they want. Large, high profit, heavily committed to Cisco branding, and willing to pay, you know, over the odds for products on the basis of partnerships or relationships.
Yeah, the days of Cisco having 70-80% market share in whatever business they were in are gone. We've seen that. That's a reality that they've had to accept. And clearly, we've been talking for a long time about Cisco moving to a revenue software subscription model. And I noted in the analyst conference, Chuck Robbins said, quote, "We are succeeding in transforming our business model with 78% of our software revenue now sold as subscription." So they are fully embracing this transition.
Even if the customer doesn't want it.
That's right. Kicking and screaming.
Yeah. And like I said, if you don't like it, that's too bad. Cisco doesn't want you as a customer if you're not going to pay for the subscriptions, because Cisco needs that subscription revenue to justify its share price. And that means you don't matter, by the way. Just in case you didn't realize that.
But after all those steak dinners, I thought we were friends.
Virtual steak dinners? Is that what?
Okay, yeah, maybe it'll be with subscription. It's virtual steak dinners.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
All right. Well, that wraps up the news. Stay tuned for our Tech Bytes conversation with Zscaler. It's going to be all about how to prevent ransomware attacks. That's coming right up.
Welcome to Tech Bytes, a 15-minute podcast at the intersection of IT and business. Today, we're talking with Zscaler, or as I like to say, Zscaler, on securing VPNs. There's been a really rapid transition to working out of the office that's changed the security posture for most organizations, moving from a centralized work, usually in a branch or attached to a campus, to distributed work, most often connected via some sort of remote access technology, is really changing the security posture and the way we have to consider security. Most of us are still thinking about connectivity, but now that we're getting to settle into this new normal, if you want to overuse a word, our users are unsupervised, we don't really know where they are, and we've got to start thinking about how we're going to address this problem. Joining me today is Lisa Lorenzen, who is a Director of Transformation Strategy at Zscaler. Welcome to the show, Lisa.
Thank you. It's lovely to talk with you.
Oh, you say that now. Let's get straight into this. Look, there's so many challenges around VPNs, I can barely know where to start, but we want to focus today on the era of ransomware. How does Zscaler think about VPNs in the era of distributed work?
So in the previous conversation with my colleague, Nate Howe, y'all had a great conversation around a new model for secure work from anywhere, dynamic granular access with full visibility and consistent security policies that follow the user no matter where they go. But I'd like to look a little deeper into why this is necessary. VPNs have worked well for over 20 years. So what's driving people to move away from them? And when we start to explore that, we find two focal points. One is attack surface, and another one is user experience.
Attack surface, that's interesting. That's not normally something that we've heard people talk about. Are we talking about VPN attack surface at the edge or at the core? Because really, there's only two places where a VPN is insecure, is at the device edge and at the VPN concentrator itself.
Absolutely. And it's both. When you talk about external attack surface, there's a number of ways that can manifest. When you move applications to the cloud, often there's a temptation to make them publicly visible and rely on single sign-on and user authorization to protect them.
Yeah.
But that's obviously a big increase in attack surface. We have an internet attack surface analysis tool that relies on publicly available information to identify possible vulnerabilities in cloud published applications. And we ran this recently against a Fortune 500 company, and the test results were pretty shocking. We found for this particular target, 342 vulnerabilities in exposed servers, 495 exposed instances on public cloud providers, some of which may have been intentional, but maybe not all of them, and 378 servers with outdated encryption protocols. And that's just one example where an organization came to us and said, what can you see when you look at us? And we were able to tell them.
Okay. So what you're saying is I've got all of these servers and now suddenly I've presented them to the public internet so that remote work can occur, so people outside of the office can get access. Mm-hmm. But really, they're not security ready or they're not up to date and ready for that experience.
Absolutely. And it can be really hard to manage. There are tools like Cloud Security Posture Management that can help identify misconfigurations or check out cloud security against existing frameworks. But the more common approach is to not publicly expose them. So you put them behind a VPN instead.
Yeah.
And this is where the attack surface becomes less obvious, because insecure VPN servers are the gift that keeps on giving for attackers.
Well, the point is it's a honeypot behind the VPN. If you can hit the VPN concentrator and compromise it, then usually what you just said was the servers that are behind it are always insecure to some level because they're not exposed to the internet most often. So that's what you want, is to compromise.
Right. So again, there's external attack surface and internal attack surface. If you look at one big example this year, in January, TravelX was hit with ransomware on New Year's Eve 2020, and they paid millions in ransom, but they were forced into bankruptcy regardless. When we look at the kill chain for that attack, attackers scanned the internet for unpatched VPN servers. They targeted the VPN server itself. When they compromised the VPN server, not only did they have access to the internal network, but they also got access to logs, cached passwords in plain text. They were able to leverage that information to gain domain admin access. And at that point, it's game over, right?
They got really lateral in there. Once they were through the VPN concentrator, they went lateral and got a footholds everywhere that mattered and were able to own TravelX left, right, up, down.
Right. They were deleting backups. They were disabling endpoint security. They pushed the ransomware, the Sodinokibi ransomware, to the network systems. And that's how TravelX ended up in the position they were, all because the VPN itself is an attack surface.
Well, the obvious point of this discussion is that Zscaler has got something in this space. How do you solve that then? Because we talked in the previous show about how Zscaler has got the VPN capability, the traffic flows into the Zscaler cloud, it gets the benefits of all the Zscaler functionality as it goes through the cloud, it gets the logging and the inspection if that's what you choose, gets the increased security and that sort of stuff. But how do you solve this VPN problem then?
Well, let's talk through it one item at a time. The core underlying problem was unpatched VPN servers. So the VPN gateway in question, the vulnerability was found in 2019. In April of 2020, a year later, the U.S. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, CISA, issued a new warning that cautions that organizations using these VPN servers may still be vulnerable to hacking, even if they applied patches for the vulnerability, because attackers were still, a year later, using compromised Active Directory credentials to gain network access. So fundamentally, patching is good, but it's also hard. We have a solution that is a cloud-enabled security service, and the management of the software updates and maintenance on that service is our responsibility. So when you install the agent, for example, you have a choice whether you want to manage agent updates via your endpoint management platforms or whether you want the agent to be automatically kept up to date on a particular version or on the latest version. When you deploy the connector components that deliver traffic, we keep those connector components running the latest versions of our code, so that you don't have to.
This is the feature of your architecture, of course, right? It's centrally hosted. You have your own data centers that you control, which is part of your security posture. And in there is the code. And you're effectively doing this continuous deployment of your infrastructure. So as and when you find a problem or you become aware of a problem for whatever reason, internally, externally, whatever it is, you're saying basically you're going to patch it and it's going to be fixed across the board.
Absolutely. And that's one of the huge benefits of a cloud-enabled service, is that responsibility for patching and updates and maintenance is on us. Another big challenge with VPN is that in August, a hacker published a list of plain text usernames and passwords, along with IP addresses, for over 900 enterprise VPN servers. And that list was shared on a Russian-speaking hacker forum frequented by multiple ransomware gangs. It had everything from SSH keys, IP addresses and firmware versions for the servers, lists of all of the local users and their password hashes, admin account details, last VPN logins, including usernames and passwords.
What didn't they have? That's everything you need. All you've got to do now is go and do the work.
And he got it by scanning the entire internet IPv4 address space for vulnerable VPN servers.
Right.
So what can we do to prevent that? We can make ourselves invisible. A VPN gateway inherently has an inbound listener that waits for the VPN client to connect to it. Mm-hmm. Our solution does away with that inbound listener. Our app connectors, which is the replacement component for that VPN server, makes an outbound-only connection to the Zscaler cloud. It's TLS encrypted, mutually authenticated, and certificate pinned, so attackers can't target either the cloud infrastructure or the connector infrastructure. They can't scan to find the connectors. They can't send any kind of crafted attacks towards them. The other benefit for our solution is that we integrate with your identity and access management, or ICAM. No credentials are ever stored within Zscaler for your users. So there is no way to compromise our service and then extract the kind of information that they were extracting from these VPNs.
So basically what you're saying there is that I need to provide my identity management solution, whether it's Active Directory or some other identity tool, but Zscaler is not presenting that to me. That's something that I have to secure. It's also not scannable because it's probably on my corporate office and it's behind a safe and secure VPN that you've already talked about.
Right. Whether you're using an on-premise identity and access management or whether you're using a cloud-enabled identity service, either way, we connect the user to it. They get a SAML assertion. We use that to determine policy, but we're never part of the authentication process.
I want to come back to that certificate pinning just for a minute, because that's really important, because certificate pinning solves a lot of the TLS weaknesses and so forth. Like if you've got a VPN and it's running SSL3, SSL3 is now compromised. If you're running TLS1, you've got problems around that. If you're using modern TLS with certificate pinning, that's, well, for all intents and purposes, unhackable today.
Right. You can't man in the middle of the communications between our infrastructure components, and you can also piggyback on our security for your legacy web apps. If you have a web server that's only running weakly encrypted ciphers, you don't have to publicly expose that. You can encapsulate that traffic in our strongly encrypted connections, and then we are protecting against those SSL vulnerabilities on the server until you have a chance to get around to updating it.
And if it's an Oracle server, you know, or one of those vendors who's a little bit laggardly when it comes to patching the stuff or making the patches available, you can put it safely somewhere where it can't be found. Like that's part of this. It's not security by obscurity, but when you put something on the internet publicly, it's vulnerable. Right? It's right. Not obscure. It's effectively waving a little flag saying, I'm here to be found, right? A bit like your house on Google Maps is visible, right? And that's the first part in scanning for whether I can break into your house. Similar sorts of problems.
Well, and speaking of breaking into your house, when we sent all of our users home due to COVID-19, one of the big security considerations, as you mentioned with ransomware, it's not just that companies could be compromised by targeting the company infrastructure. More and more, we're seeing attacks against the remote user as well. So now that user is on a home network, maybe shared with multiple people working, kids in school. They are accessing corporate resources over the same network as all this other traffic. They may be vulnerable to web-based attacks.
Oh, yeah, or lateral movement inside of the house. You know, if you've got a partner or a kid and the kid's laptop is compromised and they've got access to the work laptop, lateral.
Completely. So we need to be able to protect their outbound traffic. And we also need to be able to detect when these kind of compromises take place. So Zscaler's cloud service not only protects internally bound traffic to private applications, but we also give you protection and visibility for externally bound traffic to open internet and software as a service, and the visibility to see when an endpoint is behaving in a way that indicates that it may be compromised.
The thing I like about all of this too is it also it scales. You've probably got an existing strategy in place for VPN today, but if you jump to something like Zscaler, you've actually got this pre-existing infrastructure. You don't have to try and scale it up. You don't have to go and buy hardware boxes. The thing that's in the back of my mind is if you're listening to this and you think this might be something that you want from Zscaler, you don't actually have to go and buy all of it at once. You can actually buy it piece by piece and start migrating your users one at a time. It's not a hurdle that you have to cross to start using this. It's an on-ramp.
Right. And if we rewind to March, I spoke with an enterprise security architect at a major bank. When they sent all their users home, they realized that their VPN infrastructure did not have the capacity to support them all. And they told critical users that they could access the VPN from 5 a.m. to 5 p.m. and non-essential workers had to access it only between 5 p.m. and 5 a.m. With Zscaler, you know, you're not going to run into that. You scale at our pace. And frankly, at the same time period, as we started to see traffic ramping up on our global ZPA service, as Europe started to send people home, we realized we were going to have to scale up at a pace we'd never attempted before. In 3 weeks in March, we deployed the infrastructure we had planned out for the next 18 months.
Oh, I've got lots of stories like that, but you guys are absolutely at the center of all this.
We were able to scale by leveraging cloud-hosted infrastructure ourselves. And this also means that we can really give a more transparent user experience because accessing private applications, you can cloudify that application so the user can't see a difference between open internet, software as a service, infrastructure as a service, or data center applications. You don't have to think about whether your VPN is connected, where you're connecting to, and it's all accessed in the same way and protected the same way.
Yeah, this is that software-defined perimeter idea that we're seeing so much of these days. These clients that we put onto the edge devices are centrally managed, so you have a consistent policy everywhere.
Absolutely, and the Secure Access Service Edge also comes into it because we push the compute out as close to the user as possible, so we're not backhauling them around in our cloud, and the companies don't have to backhaul them around an internal network either.
Well, if people want to get more information, where can they go?
One great resource is our annual user conference, which has gone virtual this year. Zenith Live has workshops, breakout sessions, training, and roundtables. It's going to happen the week of December 7th. Training all week. The Americas version is December 8th and 9th, and the international version is December 9th and 10th. You can find more information at www.zscaler.com/zenithlive.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today. This has been actually quite delightful. It's a little bit of I hadn't thought about is that VPN concentrators are sort of sitting duck targets in some cases. And I suspect, although we didn't mention the name, I suspect I know the name of the vendor who's been having a tough time with their VPN compromises being owned left and right on the internet. If you'd like more information on this and other fine free podcasts from the Packet Pushers Network, head on over to packetpushers.net where you can find out lots more information. Thanks to Zscaler for sponsoring us today. You can find out more. They've got a particularly good ebook that I want to recommend to you. It's zscaler.com, securing-remote-work. It's actually well done. I talked about it in the last show. It's a really nice piece of ebook. If you want some more brain food to think about how VPNs can work, I found it quite useful. As always, you can follow us on Twitter at @PacketPushers, find us on LinkedIn, and rate us on Apple Podcasts. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.